You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our favorite picture wasn't even nominated for your awards. Let's be honest here. I didn't watch the Oscars. I usually don't. Why? They're predictable. I don't mean that it's easy to figure out who's going to win. I mean that it's the celebration of the same style and content across the board. Very rarely does an honoree deviate from the Academy's predisposition for naturalism and social justice, which not so coincidentally go hand in hand. Don't believe me? Consider the fact that Interstellar won 0 awards and was only nominated in technical categories. Joining me this week via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
Doing pretty well because I have some exciting news to share with you guys. You just want to hear it.
No, we don't. Nope. We don't want to hear it. Shut up. Go
Too
ahead.
Too bad. I mentioned, I think, on my Facebook page, for those of you that are friends with me on Facebook, I'm going to take some time off from social media. And when I take time off, I do go like the whole way. I actually suspend the accounts, close them down for a little bit. And then I go so far as to delete them from like my phone and from my iPad and all that. So I'm going to be doing that again. I don't know exactly for how long, but I thought that this would be a great idea for a segment for the podcast.
I think that works awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of called, we'll call it the off the grid. What do you think?
William, you're usually a listener versus a participant. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. How do you live off the grid? Off the social grid.
What I find interesting here, Elliot, is that you're just deleting them all. You're not even just like deleting the apps. You're just saying, no, I'm shutting these accounts down and everything, which first of all takes a follower away from me on Twitter. So thank you for that. But second of all, that seems a little unnecessary to go that far.
First of all, it's a teachable moment, if I may borrow from the social justice warriors. To be perfectly honest, I just feel like a little oversaturated with a lot of things because I'm a huge participant in social media in a lot of ways. And I feel like it's kind of detracting from some other values that I want to pursue and from some other projects that I want to devote some time to. So I have a very finite amount of time and I just kind of want to make sure that I'm allocating it to the things that really matter. And at the end of the day, social media, as much as I enjoy it, it doesn't really matter right now.
Right, so now you have more time to do prep for the podcast.
I'll never have time to do prep for the podcast, but that's part of what it makes it so fresh. At least that's the excuse that, I don't know, it's the excuse that some other people use.
Also joining us this week via Skype from the beach known for its length, subbing for Daniel, William Green. How are you, William?
Doing great. Doing great. Glad to be back for my, this is my second installment, so it can only get better.
So is it true that it is not easy being green? And how often do people ask you that?
It is not easy being green. It's been tough, the last week, or so. I'm newly single. So unlike Elliot, I'll be actually not, being digitally Amish. I'm going to be doing the opposite. I'm going to be reopening up old accounts on things like Tinder. And putting myself back out there on the market, any single guys, you know, Long Beach area, want to come hang out, have a bourbon, do some rock climbing. You know, I got to put that stuff out there now.
It's the law of conservation of social media. Accounts cannot be created or destroyed. They're only transferred.
Transferred over.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Well, Elliot, you mentioned, teachable moments. Apparently there's been another teachable moment this week because the Oscars aren't progressive enough for the SJWs. Let's scroll through the latest hashtag in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Mm-hmm.
So first up, is red carpet coverage sexist? Battle lines are drawn at the Oscars over the hashtag AskHerMore. So apparently it's not a good idea to ask who you're wearing. From the article it says, should who you're wearing be banned as a staple Oscars question? This year's award season has been marked by a growing conversation about whether reporters are asking women the right kinds of questions on the red carpet, and a hashtag offering solutions with AskHerMore. So have you guys heard about this? Did anyone watch the coverage this weekend?
Are they saying, like, asking the wrong questions where they're just like DTF, or they just like send a dick pic? Is that what they're talking about? Those are the wrong kind of questions?
No, apparently telling a woman on the red carpet that she, asking her what she's wearing, that it looks beautiful, who's the designer of her clothes, is seen as a little bit detracting. I mean, shouldn't you ask about her career or something else? I think that's kind of what's happened here. I mean, from the article, it says, this year, the Screen Actors Guild Awards, Jennifer Aniston and a couple other folks, Reese Witherspoon, all refused to put their hands in E's famous Manny Cam, which I didn't even know was going on. And then apparently there was some other controversy. For example, Nicole Kidman refused to answer Ryan Seacrest when he asked her who she was wearing at the Grammys, and went as far as pretending she didn't understand the question. Quote, I don't know what to say, she responded.
I mean, to be fair, that is kind of a ridiculous question. I mean, has anyone replied, you know, your mother? And then when they're like, what are you talking about? No, I skinned her last night. Like, who are you wearing? It's sort of an absurd question.
It came from Joan Rivers. May she rest in peace. Somebody else that we'll discuss, I'm sure, in regards to the Oscars. But, I mean, here's the thing. All right, and this is why I kind of think that this article is probably written by a straight guy. Because everybody knows, if you're a woman and if you're gay, you know that these kind of questions on the red carpet, they're not really about the actress or the celebrity that's wearing them. It's about the designer. You want the designer to get recognition. It's an industry. I mean, they're paid. Some of these actresses have contracts to promote the designer so that the designer will sell more clothes. If they like what you're wearing, if the public likes what you're wearing on the red carpet, then they'll want to go and buy the dresses, order them online, or visit their department stores or their outlet stores or whatever. That's why they ask that question. It's not just about the actress. So these women who are upset about this nonsense, they completely miss the point. It's not about them.
Elliot, you're absolutely right. In fact, in the article, it says Ryan Seacrest tried to eliminate the who are you wearing question in 2010 and was roundly criticized for it. Quote, hey, Ryan, talk to the dress, quote, read a New York Times style column headline that detailed the backlash from fashion bloggers. Quote, it was almost like he wasn't that interested in the designers, designer Nicole Miller said. He seemed more interested in the celebrities and their careers.
Goodness forbid.
There's so much context dropping going on here. Look, people have 364 days out of the year to ask the people about their careers. Although I noticed, William, you did say Jennifer Aniston before refused to participate in this. Does she really want people asking about her career?
You know, that's a good question, but it was actually the Manny Cam, which, no offense, but I would have also refused to participate in the Manny Cam.
Well, that's because messed up from all the rock climbing.
From climbing, I know. That would look really disgusting. I wouldn't want anyone to have to see that.
But no, my point is, this is a unique event, right? Where all of these people get dressed up and they wear these fancy outfits. So wouldn't it make sense that this would be the one time of year where they ask, what are you wearing? Because they're spending all of this money. I mean, it's sort of like prom for the movie industry. And isn't that a big element of prom, is who are you wearing? What are you wearing? So yeah. Isn't it dropping context to say that this is offensive to women because they're not asking about their careers? If they weren't doing interviews with the women throughout the year and asking about their careers, then I would say, yes, this is an issue. But if random actress comes in who isn't nominated for anything, so say Halle Berry came in this year, and I'm sure she did, and they ask her, well, who are you wearing? I mean, what are they going to ask her? Have you recovered from Catwoman yet? Like, she didn't do anything relevant this year.
And, you know, I'm not going to have – I can't believe I'm getting in this position, but, the article actually has a great point about standing up for Ryan Seacrest. Apparently, to prepare for the Oscars, he watches every movie that's been nominated. Can you imagine having to do that, some of the horrific, naturalistic movies you'd have to watch to prepare for for interviewing these airhead celebrities.
Yeah, but he's used to putting up with American Idol, so I'm not sure which is worse.
Once you got
and
this,
I guess
that's cool thing, I'm sure it's once you've been through that, so anything is easy.
So I guess also, I guess during a phone interview, Seacrest took a look at Seacrest's prepared questions for the Oscars, and there's not a single fashion question on the cards. So, it's interesting that this is such a controversy at the Oscars this year. It seems a little bit manufactured.
Why wasn't there the controversy a few years ago when they let Kristen Chenoweth interview people? Now look, I love Kristen Chenoweth, alright? She's a great actress, she's a great singer. But you don't want that woman talking to people or talking on air.
I mean, so what do you do? Do you ask someone about? Do you ask?
Like the gauge just went quiet. Like, oh no, oh no.
Yeah. No, I'm outnumbered. Daniel would have backed me up on that one.
Well, I was going to say, what do you do? Do you ask a star on the red carpet? Who she's wearing? Do you compliment her on her dress? Is that sexist? Or do you ask her about her career and ignore the fact that she's dressed up?
Well, that's the whole thing of the social justice war. That's the whole thing of it. There is no right answer. There are no proper rules. There really isn't, because no matter what you do, somebody's going to get offended. And if your standard of what's right and wrong to say is whether or not someone's going to get offended, then we will go around saying absolutely nothing. They might as well just abolish and abandon doing interviews on the red carpet at all, if that's going to be the issue. I mean, that's why the social justice war is a race to the bottom. I keep saying this. Yeah. People eat themselves.
Well, and not to get all gay on you, but I definitely want to know who designed Neil Patrick Harris's suit and whether I can actually have Neil Patrick Harris with or without the suit.
How dare you? He is married. You back off. Although, I mean, well, you could probably, it's probably a two for one thing.
Oh God.
You could probably get Neil Patrick Harris and maybe his husband as well. Send the kids off with grandma and grandpa.
And on that bombshell.
Yeah, I'm a little.
Next story.
Yeah.
A little weirded out. Moving on. Five questions that movie plots never seem to answer. So, can you guys guess what are the five questions that movie plots never seem to answer? Here's question number five.
Well, it's important. How is everybody blowed? I think it's important to note where this article is from.
Oh, yeah, it's from Cracked. Yeah, that's a very important fact that I left out right there.
Yeah, it's
so from Cracked.com.
Of course, it's from Cracked. So that should tell you about this.
All right. So number five was, how is everybody blow drying their hair? It's the end of the world. Reliable electricity is a forgotten dream. Gangs roam the earth in a post-apocalyptic clothing, fighting each other for scraps of pilot goggles and hobo gloves. Men are grizzled and bearded because in this dark future, blades are for stabbing, not for shaving. And then the women are running around with hair like this, and they're showing beautiful curls and well-kept hair. So how does we apparently need to explain why hair dryers exist in the post-apocalypse.
This is the same thing that stupid woman from BuzzFeed talked about with the Walking Dead and the female action stars having shaved their armpits, complaining about that.
So let me go through the rest of them quick, and then I'm sure we can tear them apart. But number four was, how are they going to the bathroom in those suits? And they give the example of the X-Men suits and other superhero suits like Batman.
Or everyone and then loves number 24, three, right? Everyone says they love 24.
Yeah. Number three is, how is everyone getting around Los Angeles? Which I think is a totally legitimate gripe. I mean, that takes anybody who's from LA right out of the movie.
To the rest of us who, when we're from another place, we see that it's not actually filmed in the place it says it's filmed in.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I love it when, I grew up in Michigan, and whenever they film something that's supposedly in Michigan or Detroit, I'm always like, that's not how Detroit looks, you know, there's no palm trees in Detroit. Yeah, there's no palm trees in Detroit. Number two was, who is waxing these people? 80% of white males have at least some hair on their upper bodies, apparently. Number one was, what do all these sexy people smell like? Which really didn't make any sense to me even after I read that section.
There's Cracked, reaching for that content.
But they did show lots of pictures of stars, you know, with their shirts off. So I'm sure they got a lot of clicks.
It's just naturalism. That's what this is. Nobody gives a shit about how you go to the bathroom. Nobody gives a shit how you smell. All right? It has nothing to do with the plot or with the point of the story. Nobody cares. I mean, this is, no wonder Interstellar didn't win anything. Just because if this is the mentality running the industry, then that's why.
Well, to be fair, Crack's not running the industry, but I did include this on the outline because it does follow up on the whole Oscars thing and what William was saying, that Ryan Seacrest must have watched a lot of naturalism. The fact that people even have these questions enter their mind when they're watching these movies. I mean, go back and watch these old black and white movies, these classic movies, Gone with the Wind. Look at the way they're made up in that movie. Like, that was before there was all sorts of modern technology in that world in order to get people that well done up, but they still did them up. You know, look at a Casablanca and the way that is. And people are going to sit here and they're going to complain that, you know, their hair is done up and they don't go to the bathroom. It just, when did it become that people wanted to watch these things? I mean, I understand Cracked is trying to be funny, but the joke here is that it's absurd that these movies don't have this in it. But my question to you is, would you want to have this style in there? Would you want to watch these things?
Yeah, do you really want to see Captain America wiping his ass? I mean, really, come on.
Well, Elliot, you might, just because you get to see his ass.
I'm not German.
The wrong context. Yeah, that's the wrong context, man. So, you know, I wonder, though, that there is a little nugget here when it comes to, like, the LA example. I kind of joked about it, but you know, if sometimes in some stories the setting is essential. It's like almost like its own character. You know, you see this in a lot of like the very like, you know, iconic like Japanese movies taking place in Tokyo, or the movies that take place in New York City or Chicago. The setting is almost like a character, right? And you know, if they put palm trees in the background, like if it's clearly recorded in, you know, somewhere in Ventura County, like it's not. It does take you out of the sort of suspension of disbelief. So there's a little tiny nugget in here, but that's certainly not naturalism, right? Like that's not what the article is kind of calling for of like, you know, how do they go to the bathroom?
Yeah, it's a question of craftsmanship at that point. Editing, continuity. There's a legitimate reason to kind of call those things out. But I think what the bigger point that they're getting at is that they don't think that they want to know why these stories aren't more realistic. You know, so, I mean, cause she even writes he writes in the column, you know, like, well, why, if they want to be more gritty and realistic, don't they have gritty and realistic things? I mean, and I think that's just, I think they're confusing style over content or over theme, if you get my drift.
Well, right. And that's what people always say about The Dark Knight. It wasn't really realistic, you know, wasn't really gritty. That was just the style it was in. Yeah, because it was romanticism. But I do think even with the LA point is they're still looking for naturalism. Time is an element that is played with in a story where you accept that time isn't realistic. Now, when you look at something like 24, even though 24 was supposed to be, 24 hours a day, every minute of the episode was a minute of the real life for Jack Bauer.
A real time.
Right. It was supposed to be in real time. It wasn't a mirror 100% of reality. Because, you know, when you have the outwardness of naturalism, it has to be realistic. But they were just playing with that as a way of emphasizing the tension and the drama and how every minute counted. And people are confusing this. The reason you don't have people get stuck in traffic and the reason you have them get across LA quickly is it would not make a good story to show someone stuck in traffic or not be able to deal with the LA time. We saw this in, was it the premiere of Scorpion? Was that set in L.A.? Where they had to get across L.A. quickly, and they did? Because really, in that first episode, they would have been like, oh, we're in L.A. We're actually fucked. The world's over.
Yeah.
That doesn't make for a good story. You have to – that's part of suspension of disbelief is understanding as a viewer, well, the reality of the situation would mean you can't have a time crunch in L.A., which takes away so many tricks – and so many tools is a better word, out of the writers, out of the producers, out of the director's toolbox, that it just destroys any story creation.
Yeah, the only way that the only time it would be acceptable to focus on something like traffic is if that's the opposition to your goal. If you need to get somewhere.
So it's the movie Speed, you're basically talking about Speed.
What?
Speed.
Anything Yeah, movies like that, when it becomes the antagonistic force that prohibits you from the character from achieving his or her goal, then you can focus and dwell on the traffic, and then you can kind of play it up. But if it doesn't serve the story, it doesn't need to be there. And all that stuff, all that crap, any director worth his salt is just going to leave that crap on the floor of the cutting room.
Or not even let it get in there to cut it.
Yep.
So, well, I guess from trying to stick to reality, we go to people who pretend about reality. John Kerry. John Kerry issued a climate warning saying there is no planet B. So Secretary of State John Kerry continued to beat the drum on the dangers of climate change Friday, noting that there is no planet B. I think he actually lives on planet B. If you listen to any of the climate rhetoric coming out of John Kerry, I think he lives on a planet where this is happening, and it's happening at the levels that he's claiming, but it's not the planet that we live in.
You would think he's from the state of Massachusetts, right? You would think he would understand with all the snow going on there that there's no such thing as global warming.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say there's no such thing as global warming, because most people don't even know what that even means. But he certainly is an advocate in the catastrophic sort of, you know, hundreds of degrees warmer over thousands of years, like we burn the planet up. He's in that camp.
And it's our fault. Humans, we screw it up. That's his basic point.
This is a story where, no offense, William, I love having you here, but this is a story that it's just begging for Daniel.
I cannot do better than what he would do with this story, but I can't have the level of rage. I have that rage in me, but just not his level of rage. This is why I'm only a substitute and not a real, full-time, host here on the podcast. But quote from Kerry, So a quote from Kerry here. And we have been allies in trying to awaken the world to the dangers of climate change. And let me just say that when it comes to the fundamental health of the Earth, folks, we better stick to the Creator's original plan, because there is no planet B.
Wow. Wow. I mean, Peikoff was right. There is that merge between, like, the religious circles and the environmentalist circles that it's happening.
You know, I have a really different take on this, you know, part of my background and career. You know, I think there are some planet Bs out there, you know, provided we unlock enough energy here on Earth. There's plenty of planet Bs out there. The whole idea that there's a planet here that's ready to take care of us, if only we would take care of it, is just so backwards. I mean, that's not the way people survive. People survive by using their mind. And we survive by changing the environment around us. And with our mind, there's almost no environment that we can't conquer. And that's the truth about reality. That there is no planet A either is really the answer to what Kerry is saying. We make our living space.
Yeah, we make our planet safer. The planet wasn't safe before we got here. It was always unsafe. We have made it safer because of our minds, because of what we have done to lift ourselves out of the state of destitution that many of us were born in.
Well, I'm going to call a little audible here. I guess we're done with that story. I'm going to call a little audible here. Add one little story of my own in here. In the your need is not a claim on my life category. Michigan, my alma mater, is going to offer need-based prices for Michigan football tickets. Headline, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Michigan's policy for student football tickets now includes needs-based discounts based on federal Pell Grant eligibility. This is going to reduce the price of men's basketball tickets from $200 to $120, hockey tickets from $150 to $90, and football tickets will receive about a $100 discount.
Wait, I'm confused. Who is this discount going to?
People who have federal Pell Grants. So they come from low-income families. When they fill out their FASFA form, they make less than a certain amount per year.
Students,
yes.
Michigan doesn't give free tickets to undergrad students?
Nope.
How many people sit in that stadium?
A lot. Over 100,000.
No, that's the real problem with Michigan. Where's their school spirit? I mean, Clemson has a student section and they give tickets away, and people who want to line up and get those tickets get them. And then grad students pay for them, and then everyone else pays for them. So there's a section
There are so many people, so many students that want tickets that they definitely sell out of students' tickets every year. There's 109,901 capacity at Michigan Stadium. And, they basically sell, there's a huge student section, about, I'd say about, probably an eighth of the stadium is students, is the student section. And that includes, you know, you get set, back when I was an undergrad, you got seated in order of how many years you have bought season tickets. So if you had bought them since your freshman year and you were like a PhD candidate, you're probably sitting in the frickin' front row.
But why would you want to sit in the front row for a football game? All you have is all the players in front of you and you can't see anything.
I don't know. I never had to deal with that problem.
It depends on the players. I mean, if Rob Gronkowski were sitting right in front of me, sir, it would be I would pay a lot for that.
This is the gayest episode of the podcast ever.
And it's not my fault. I'm not taking the blame here.
Well, yeah, I mean, Elliot feels safe because of you, William.
Well, maybe he feels repressed around you, Justin.
Probably. I am a white male.
My gender identity.
And I am talking about football.
I brought football into the podcast. It's not even football season. I get credit for straightening it out a bit.
Well, we're going to get to football later on when we name a narcissist. But isn't Michigan usually at the forefront of these social justice things? Weren't they one of the first people who did affirmative action at their school too?
Yep, and we were actually, our affirmative action was ruled unconstitutional back when I was an undergrad. I was actually, though, under the unconstitutional system that was being used, I was actually a minority. White me, from small town in Michigan, was from an underrepresented poor county in Michigan, so I got as many points as a rich black kid from Detroit.
Well, if that doesn't show the system is broken, I don't know what does. even the affirmative action system is broken. Jesus.
Exactly. The white guy got into Michigan due to affirmative action, so.
Need-based stuff just never works. I mean, I truly it doesn't. Although I would love to see it employed in something like, I don't know, prostitution, like a need-based pricing. I'd be curious to see how, like, you would judge that.
I'm trying to project myself back to undergrad. You know, after my sophomore year, you end up selling most of your tickets for, you know, beer money. But, you know, you can't do that anymore because Michigan basically sucks right now. Although we've got a good coach. We're going to turn things around, hopefully. But, you know, the last few years, it's been pretty terrible.
Has the potential to actually be a good rivalry again when you have Urban Meyer versus, I'm blanking on his name. Harbaugh.
Harborough, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a Seminole fan. Go Seminoles. FSU. Yay.
Oh, man.
All right. Well,
nobody likes you.
Nobody likes you. Get away.
Well, that finishes up the news. And I'm not the only one not watching the Oscars this year. We check the ratings in TV with JML. According to Variety, the Oscar ratings are down 16%, and they're at their lowest in 6 years. There's a paragraph here that says, "This year's Oscar ceremony has joined other award shows from this television season in posting year-over-year rating declines, down 10% in the overnights from last year's decade-best score, which we saw that it became 16%. But the interesting thing to me here is that the ratings are going down year after year. Now, the question I have for you guys is this simply a result of the fact that everyone's DVRing everything, so nobody cares about, like, event television like this anymore? Or is this that people are becoming disenchanted with these awards? Or somebody's going to say false dichotomy, so.
I think it's the fact that most of the Best Picture nominees, nobody has really seen yet. I mean, except probably American Sniper. But I think this has been a problem for a while now. I mean, a lot of the movies that get nominated for Best Picture, most people don't want to go see. I think a lot of people just are not drawn to those kind of stories. So they don't really go out of their way to see them. So when they get these big nominations, they don't really care, you know?
So is that a vote for no people becoming disenchanted with the award ceremony?
Yeah, I guess you could say that, yeah.
What do you think?
I think the whole Oscars is just a Hollywood masturbatory session. I mean, it's very, what does Hollywood want Hollywood to be? And not in this sort of like bright celebration of Hollywood, but in this sort of, we are the cultural elite and we're going to congratulate ourselves on being different than our customers, on being outside and better than, the plebeians who enjoy things like, you know, American Sniper or any of the other, you know, blockbuster movies. You know, we're more sophisticated than that. We're the intellectual sort of artistic ones, and the art that we like is different and better and just unreachable by everyone else. And that's just so not true. I can't imagine, you know, like, you know, not everyone likes classical music, but I can't imagine, you know, someone just coming up with, you know, years and years from now, pulling out, you know, John Cage and like appreciating it like it's high art. I just can't imagine that happening, you know, and same thing with a lot of the movies that we've got Oscars. I mean, you go back to the 80s or the 70s and pull up some of the Oscar, winners, and they're not relevant at all artistically.
Yeah, it's funny actually you say that. There was an article by Slate about how they were upset that Birdman won the best Oscar and Boyhood didn't. So they're even arguing amongst themselves about how much of a travesty it was. I mean, this Slate article said that it was the biggest travesty in the history of not given rewards. And to be fair, I mean, conceptually, I was actually sort of surprised that Boyhood didn't do better when I was making predictions to be in an Oscar pool. I looked at it and I said, you know, Boyhood seems like it's up the naturalistic, the naturalistic alley of the Oscars with the way it was done conceptually. So I'm just very surprised it didn't do better. And it's funny that they're sort of infighting over all of this at this point.
It was just, I mean, for me personally, I didn't watch because as much as I love movies, I don't love these movies that were nominated. I mean, obviously I have to give props to like Big Hero 6, you know, being a company man. I got to give props to Disney Films getting these things, but.
And the Disney short one too, Feast.
Yeah, Feast. Yes. I mean, just, but I, other than that, I mean, I don't really care for these movies. I mean, the only movie last year that I really loved was Interstellar, and it didn't get any nominations except for, like you said, like for technical categories. And that just like, it just like broke my heart really, that it just got ignored. That's how I felt, like they ignored that Christopher Nolan had put together this huge, like this almost masterpiece, you know, and it just got completely sidelined in all of this. And I just, I mean, and it's not to besmirch like American Sniper. I know a lot of people saw it and they liked it, but I mean, I really thought that that Interstellar was really going to be the one to take home all the awards.
Well, I agree completely. And there's another example of that. I know you're a company man here and you're toeing the line, but Daniel said a couple weeks ago how Big Hero 6 wasn't that good, and the Lego Movie was completely snubbed, and that was successful in the mainstream, and it was a tremendously made movie. And even within the nominees, The Box Trolls was a tremendous movie. So we even see that it's happening in Big Hero, in the animated category with Big Hero 6, and I haven't seen Big Hero 6, so I don't know why it won, but I certainly don't see how it could have been better than The Box Trolls definitely not better than the Lego Movie.
But see, that's the big point though, isn't it? And I think William will agree with me. The problem is the criteria. How are movies getting best screenplay, best cinematography, best visual effects, best all the technical awards, but then they don't get best picture. Best director, best screenplay, best cinematography, but they don't get best picture in the end.
William, do you agree with him?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know what the selection criteria is for some of these things. The standard, you know, Justin, you've got a good point with the standard seems to be on naturalism, but there seems to be a lot of like politic sort of well, you didn't win it back when you should have when you wrote some movie years ago, so we're just going to give it to you now for some crappy movie that you made.
Yeah. It started
and
with
Shakespeare and Love. It started with who?
With Shakespeare in Love. That's where it started.
Yeah.
Because that was the year that Saving Private Ryan got Best Director, got Best Sound Editing, Cinematography, Best Adapted Screenplay, got all these awards, but then it didn't win Best Picture. Shakespeare in Love did. Which, that was, I think, the start of this slouching towards Gamora.
I mean, Elliot, I agree completely, and William, I agree completely about the whole internal politics that we'll never quite understand of the industry and all of these people and the social groups they created. But the thing I want to take issue with that you said is, just because a movie wins technical awards doesn't mean that it deserves to be Best Picture. There's a whole another side of it you're missing out on, and that's the performances. That's the writing.
No, but what I'm saying is I'm asking the criteria. What are they going by? I mean, how are they? I mean, are they looking at movies rationally and really analyzing them? And are they able? Like, if you were to ask somebody, why is Birdman the best picture of the year? Could they articulate? Could they break it down and say why? And so, I mean, I'm just using the technical awards as my personal criteria in terms of what I would use. Now, the performances matter, certainly, but there's a lot of it that goes into a best picture, in my view. So my question is, what's their criteria? How do you judge Birdman to be the best picture? What goes into it? And if it's just feelings, like, oh, I just felt like this, and I felt like that. I mean, then, I don't know, to me, that's just pure subjectivism, and I just don't understand, like, why it wins.
Well, it's exactly, I mean, it's what William was saying, it's the politics, and it's what I was saying, it's the naturalism. I mean, look at all these movies that have won Best Oscar. It's all about somebody with a disability, or somebody overcoming some sort of, or coping with some sort of deterministic universe they're stuck in that they can't deal with. It's never about someone being heroic.
So, Justin, who would you pick for Best Picture this year?
I mean, it was hands down, it was Interstellar.
What about you, William?
Well, I liked Interstellar. I don't think I really saw enough movies this last year to really justify picking a best, but
that's the other problem. I want to interrupt you because I think that's a great point you just made. That's the other problem with this circle jerk, as you said. Have all these people really seen enough movies to say what the best picture is? Couldn't there conceivably be one out there that people don't know about?
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to watch a lot of movies. And you know, I just – it's so hard. There's so many good movies out there, and I feel like a lot of them get – you know, I just watched a movie this weekend, and you look at the previews and they're nothing like what the movie is like. You know, the previews are so manufactured to bring in whatever market the marketing guys are targeting. And so I always feel like it's a risky business to go to the theater and see a movie. So I end up mostly watching movies after they've come out onto Netflix or something. But I really liked Interstellar. I don't know if it's best, if it's best picture quality. It's up there. It's up there.
I think you mentioned you saw Whiplash.
I did see Whiplash. I would have leaned more towards Whiplash. Even though this is a movie that made me very uncomfortable at times, and I definitely don't see the teacher as a hero at all, it was such an emotional trip that, and it was something I really connected to as a musician, that it's a movie that I can watch again and still hate, you know, get that feeling of hate and, for the teacher, and that sort of feeling of accomplishment and overcoming, sort of triumphing from the main character. It was a very intense movie.
Well, I haven't seen Whiplash, but I've heard a lot about it. So that is a review that makes me sort of want to see it. Just like, Daniel's review of Kingsman made me sort of want to see it. Ellie, do you have any thoughts you'd like to sum up on the Oscars?
I just want to say that Lady Gaga was fabulous, because, I mean, she took the stage and everybody was just kind of like, oh God, she's going to butcher this. She's going to butcher The Sound of Music. She's going to butcher. And she just kicked ass. It was so good. I mean, now she was not at the level of Julie Andrews. I'm not saying that, but she was a hell of a lot better than I think a lot of people expected her to be. She showed off a little bit of that classical training that she's been suppressing. And I wrote on my Facebook wall earlier that that as much as happy as that performance made me, you know, in a way it ties into the problem with the Oscars. You know, she's probably just going to go back to the stunt performing, you know, with the costumes and the outrageous things that she says and that she does. And it's not going to be about that voice anymore. It's not about the actual.
But wasn't this just a stunt? I mean, I don't have a lot of respect for Lady Gaga. So wasn't this just another stunt? I mean, everyone's talking about it because it's a different than what she's done before. I mean, how many times can you dress up in meat? I'm not sure, you know, you gotta switch back to normal, I guess, for contrast. I don't know. I need to watch performance before I really say anything more, but I'm just so skeptical of, I don't really have a deep respect for, Lady Gaga.
I mean, and I totally get it because I really am in the same boat as you, but having watched it, it blew me away. Because even if it is a stunt, it was so well done, and her performance was so well done. Her voice, her singing, the use of her range, even just the commanding presence that she took on that stage, it was so well done that even if it's a stunt, I want her to do more stunts like that, not dress up in...
That's gay.
So gay.
Told you, gayest episode ever.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of... variety shows that also have musical guests that usually are disappointing and make me fast forward through it. You like that transition?
I do.
NBC over the weekend aired a SNL 40th anniversary special that apparently did the opposite of the Oscars and smashed the ratings with 26.5 million viewers, and that includes DVR usage. Did either of you watch this?
No.
I did not. I heard about it after the fact, and I think I watched a video of Jimmy Fallon hungover the next day, but I haven't seen, I haven't actually seen it, and it's on my, is it Hulu? I think it's in my Hulu queue right now. So it's gonna get watched very soon.
I watched some of it. I watched the opening while I was putting this outline together, and I saw the Celebrity Jeopardy, and during the monologue, this is what struck me, and this is what I don't really understand about SNL. Now, I agree that there have been some iconic moments in SNL, but it seems like SNL spends a long time trying to make things iconic. So the opening monologue was Steve Martin, and then all, like, famous former hosts came out, like, you know, Tom Hanks, Alec Baldwin. At one point, they had Billy Crystal, because, of course, if you're talking about hosting, you have to have Billy Crystal. But then, in the middle of all the people coming out, Peyton Manning came out and Miley Cyrus came out, and it just sort of summed up SNL to me. Like, why in an SNL 40th anniversary special, if you're really celebrating what SNL is about, would you bring out Peyton Manning and Miley Cyrus? It seems like they're pandering just to be popular. And then my question is that just what SNL is? Because to me, 90% of the time, SNL isn't funny. And every once in a while, it happens to hit with a character, and they beat it into the ground.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I haven't watched SNL since Will Ferrell left. And I know I'm going to get so much flack for this, but I was always more of a Mad TV kind of guy. I just thought that their sketches were better written. I thought that they were more cohesive. Because even if you're going to go for laughs and do a funny sketch, it still should have a pretty cohesive story, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think too many SNL sketches just don't have that. I think that they're lacking. So I've always watched that. I never really watched SNL, not since Will Ferrell.
Yeah, I think it's the Office Space style comedy where it's just gag, gag, gag.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have as much impact or comedy without that integration.
Mm-hmm. Right, so I guess we're in agreement then with what my assessment is.
Oh, geez. Are we agreeing with Justin again?
Yes. What's the purpose of this podcast is to make me feel good about myself and my beliefs. Come on.
Or you're just oppressing us. The purpose of this podcast is so you can oppress the gays. That's what this week's podcast is about.
Then I'm failing at it miserably this week. So SNL remembered its comedy that nobody cared about over the last 40 years, yet that wasn't very good over the last 40 years, and seemingly everybody seemed to watch anyway. Well, we had another show that was remembered, Two and a Half Men. The show recently ended, And again, it had a very long run and wasn't very funny, yet still people watched it. Do you guys have any memories?
Who watched this show? Who watched this show? It was terrible.
It was terrible.
I have a like aversion to the laugh track. So like shows with laugh tracks, I don't really like. I can get past it if they're really good, but it's really hard. And I just like this show. I never laughed at anything. There was nothing funny. I remember the first couple seasons, there was just nothing funny about it. And then when it kept going and going, I was like, who is watching the show? Who's watching the show?
So is that's your memory of the show is just who's watching it?
Yes.
Watching the show.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories of it, Elliot?
No. I mean, I didn't care. I know some of like the news stories about it. Like I remember when the actor who played the boy, the half man, I mean, he was telling people, don't watch this show. It's awful. It's terrible. Don't watch it. So if your own actors are saying, don't watch this show, maybe, you know, that I honestly don't know who is watching it. I mean, I really, really don't. I mean, I guess Ashton Kutcher might have a fan base just like Charlie Sheen did, or at least used to have, but I just don't know. I really don't know who watched it.
I mean, I've seen a couple episodes just to see what it was all about. I saw it way back when it was Charlie Sheen just to see what it was about. And then when they did the whole Ashton Kutcher changeover, I saw what it was about. But it really was the same, like, two jokes every time. You know, there was a ladies' man, and then there was a guy who, you know, didn't do well with the ladies. And then they played off of each other. Just like how the Big Bang Theory is, haha, we're nerds the whole time. And mm-hmm. I assume Mike and Molly is, haha, we're fat the whole time. Because it's by the same people. So, I mean, that's what I remember about Two and a Half Men.
Well, it's just a situation. I mean, they're sitcoms, situation comedies. I mean, they're about the situation that you're in. And I think a lot of times when shows deviate from its initial situation, and I think that that's when you start kind of seeing a lot of the comedy start changing, and I think a lot of the stories start going south.
Well, Two and a Half Men, may you rest, but not in peace. Moving on, I have a question for you all. What do Dr. Phil, fat acceptance, and kicking a cat have in common?
I don't know.
Elliot, any guesses?
All subjects covered on The View.
No, it's also not the latest season of Celebrity Rehab either, though I like both those guesses. Awesome. It's Reddit on Reddit. No longer bits like that if a firefly spending too much time online. Batman's face should be shot. Can we legalize pot? TAE feel like this. Better drink my own piss. Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way. EA blow, Steam rocks. God rest for my Firefox. These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it. First Reddit. This is where we get our Dr. Phil dose in here. They did a TIL. Today I learned is what that stands for on Reddit. Today I learned Dr. Phil hasn't had a license to practice psychology professionally for 9 years and considers himself retired from psychology. This isn't a big deal to me, but this was a trending thing on Reddit when I got there. Is this a big deal to you guys?
I think the big news is that he was actually licensed at one time, actively. That seems to be the news for me. He was actually a licensed doctor of psychology. I thought he was just like, you know, like Dr. Nick from The Simpsons, like, you know, like a doctor of divinity or something. I don't know.
No, that's the whole gimmick of the show, and that's why I don't think it's a big deal. I mean, learning about this and they're saying they learned about it is like you don't understand how these shows work. Dr. Phil isn't actually doing psychology on his show. He's just giving advice. And he used the gimmick of saying, oh, look, I'm a doctor with a unique voice and a unique personality. This is why you should listen to me about my advice. There's no actual psychology going on. I think it's more disrespect to the field of psychology that they think it's psychology.
Yeah.
Well, did Oprah know that she was making a monster? That's the real question.
Justin, I have to tell you, you just can't ride two horses with one ass, all right? My grandfather used to say, so you just going to have to tinkle or get off the body.
That's not bad. That's pretty good. Better than I could do.
You got a little mustache, like, right here. Yeah, I don't care.
All right. Next Reddit. This was a shower thoughts from Reddit. Netflix is the most successful anti-piracy program ever initiated.
Ooh.
And they had a little Yahoo Answers misspelling of initiated. They forgot one of the I's. Come on, Reddit, we expect you are a higher class of scum.
That's right.
And villainy of criminals.
This is a front page of the internet, not the ass end like Yahoo Answers.
Yeah, come on. We've upped our game here and you're still misspelling stuff?
Man, next thing we'll have no Oxford comma or something.
Don't get me started on the Oxford comma, all right? The Oxford comma is important. I hate EP style. People might think the two things are together if you don't have the two commas, if you only have one.
Eat shoots and leaves, I know.
Or my parents, comma, Ayn Rand and God. They use that on Wikipedia. But anyway, what do you guys think of this claim? Netflix is the most successful anti-piracy program ever initiated.
I think this is partly a good point. The whole idea of something being more accessible and available via paid method versus an illegal method, I think that a lot of folks thought that piracy was more malicious than what it was during its height. I think a lot of people, and I think a lot of people still, don't understand the actual theft aspect. And there are a lot of, I mean, people know and understand it. There are a lot of people who do. But there's, like, I think, Justin, I was telling you when I was over at your place the other day, there's this website my roommate found and was like, here's this website. And it looks very legitimate. And there's movies there that you could just watch. And I was looking at the list of movies, and I was thinking, oh, wow, this is really cool. And then I saw some ones that are, like, in theaters currently. And I'm like, wait a minute. Where are they getting these movies from? Like, and it's not, you know, it's not clear that this was illegal downloading, like, on the face of it. So the whole idea of Netflix making it easier, I can see that to a certain extent.
Well, yeah, people have always downloaded because of convenience, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there's a segment that just don't want to pay for content, want to get something for nothing. But yeah, there's a segment that just wanted it in a different format. And a lot of quote unquote pirators, had, licensed copies. I know I got a DCMA or whatever the notice is, for supposedly downloading something that I already owned. And there was really no recourse for me to say anything about it. Because, you know, I actually owned the movie that they were accusing me of downloading. It's like, I own this movie. Like, why would I download it? And then second of all, I already own the movie. I can't possibly get in trouble for downloading it. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it sort of, doesn't make a lot of sense to me to get in trouble for downloading a movie that you already own, that I could already transcode into that particular format if I wanted to.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't be talking on this issue.
I wasn't gonna throw stones in your direction, but.
You're just gonna throw shade.
No, I can hear our listeners throwing stones though. And for me, it's about convenience in the sense that there's so much on. And if I were actually to pay for all the TV shows that were on and, you know, DVR them, I never would be able to. So I buy the DVD box sets once I decide that the show's good enough for me to do that, or I spend money on the merchandise and everything. But yeah, that's all I got.
No, but it has changed.
Rationalism. Yeah, rationalism.
It has changed how we participate in entertainment, how we enjoy the stuff. Like for me, I can, not just through Netflix and through Hulu, but even like through my Apple TV, through iTunes, I can pre-buy a season. And as the episodes air every week, I get that episode is now owned. I own it. And even after the season is over, and for years, I will own that season. And there's a lot of convenience there. There's a lot to be said for that. And I think it's just another way that the entertainment industry is just it's going to kind of decentralize away from the Hollywood and from the regular distribution means of distribution. And I used that word twice, but if you
know, that's an interesting. It's an interesting point. I've been thinking for a while. You know, a lot of people were lamenting the end of sort of the reign of broadcast television and the sort of segmentation and fragmentation that cable has brought, and now Netflix and HBO Go and other things. I think the whole idea of people paying, like voting with their dollars,
rather than just happening to watch whatever's on, is actually going to raise the bar in television. I don't think it's going to lower it. Because, frankly, I would never buy a season of, you know, Two and a Half Men or, you know, whatever other random dribble you can find on broadcast television during primetime. You know, my roommate really likes Sleepy Hollow. I know he would pay, you know, a reasonable amount to have the season of Sleepy Hollow, right? To watch it, right? He really likes the show. Mm-hmm. And so he should be able to vote with his dollars, right? I wouldn't pay for Sleepy Hollow. Like, it's not a show that really interests me. But right now I pay for all sorts of shows. In fact, most of the shows on my cable that I pay for, the exorbitant cable fee that I pay, I don't enjoy, right? I'm paying all this money for all these shows that I don't enjoy.
And your taxes go to pay for some programs too, on PBS and all these other.
Well, yeah, but it's nowhere as bad as the British Broadcasting Company.
Oh, no, nowhere. Yeah. But in principle though, like you're paying for it both by, you know, when you're paying for the cable and against your will through your taxes. So there's a reason why people kind of look at it, at the decentralization of entertainment as a really bad thing. In a lot of ways, it also informs what's going on at the Oscars. You know, I mean, the reason why these films that are nominated, they haven't really connected with a lot of audiences, except maybe American Sniper. But, I mean, because what people want to watch, when they actually, as William says, when they vote with their dollars, they don't go that route. You know, they go for, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy. They go for these other films. Now, whether we like them, these films or not, particularly Americans, I think we go for those kind of movies.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's what I was going to bring up, the Oscars. That was the point I was making when I asked, are people not watching it anymore just because there are other things available? It used to be that all of these things were popular and these people could, you know, decide more what was good because they were gatekeepers, because they were the ones in control of the broadcast medium. Yeah. Whereas now, as you guys have said, there's other means of distribution. But still, at the same time, that's what people have been saying about record labels for years since Napster. They said that the record label was going to die and the independent artists would rise up. But, I mean, I would actually assert that the mainstream has actually gotten stronger, hasn't it? It's just there's fewer mainstream artists now because it's harder to be that accepted. Whereas before, everyone had to buy your music on any level. Now, it's just that they're only buying people at the top.
Well, I'll give you an example, and this is a hint towards like one of the projects that I'm working on this year. You know, if I wanted to, let's say I can record my own music, you know, my own songs, and have it stored on my computer. I can convert it to the appropriate files. I can either go to like an aggregator and export my music, my albums to iTunes, Amazon, whatever the other websites, I don't even know if Rhapsody is around anymore. But you can export your music from your own computer. Now, I mean, you do it for a fee, but through that, you're going to be getting your music out there to a lot of people. You couldn't do that even 10 years ago. 10 years ago, you had to do a demo, you had to go play at some of the bars and some of the clubs and maybe hopefully get signed by a record label, put your album out. I mean, it was a huge deal. And now you can do it from the comfort of your own house. I mean, it's a really, really wonderful shift, and it's strengthened the music industry. It hasn't hurt it. It's strengthened it. But it does make you, to call back to what we discussed last week, it does make you wonder what's going to happen if this net neutrality nonsense takes off. I mean, it's a pretty scary thing when you realize that.
Indeed. Next Reddit. A friend of mine has joined the fat acceptance movement and is parroting studies that say diet and exercise don't work ever. Please help me.
Oh man. Where do we even begin with this one? Mm-hmm. So I read a little bit of the comments on this one and some of the discussion. So apparently, there was a group of gals and two or three of the gals had started to exercise, change their lifestyle a bit, eat healthier foods and, you know, as women tend to do, start to talk about cooking and stuff at the parties and stuff where they were hanging out with these other, with this other girl. And this other girl just sort of resented the fact that they had lost this weight and were having all these positive benefits and talking about this healthy food, and was sort of just demanding that they realize that they're just going to fail after 2 or 3 years. So, they should just give it up. They should just, accept being fat and stop repressing her with their, talk of being skinny.
It's time to kick your friend in the face is what it sounds like.
Yeah,
this can't imagine having a friend like this personally. I don't think I would use the category friend to describe someone who would resent my success in anything, even if it was temporary.
Right, they're not a friend, they're a person you kick in the face sometimes.
Man, I feel bad for your cat.
Man, I was gonna cut that story now. Man, I was gonna cut it now. I have to keep it.
Oh no! Come on!
Wait, hold on. I got something to say. Cause you guys know I'm struggling with my weight. I've lost some and I'm gonna continue to lose some. And so this story, it kinda gets me a little emotional. Here's the thing. It's not acceptance of fat that's really the core here. It's the acceptance of giving up. It's the acceptance of powerlessness and of making the choice not to improve yourself. I mean, I am kicking my own ass every day, making little changes to try to get my weight down. This sort of thing really bothers me a lot, because what you're accepting is not the fact that a person is fat. All right. What you're accepting is the idea that a person doesn't have to try. They don't have to make the change. They don't have to do this. And that's the idea behind the fat acceptance movement, that you had nothing to do with this. Screw that crap. I gained this weight because I chose to. I'm losing it because I've chosen to. Screw anybody who tries to tell me that I should just sit back and accept it.
Well, I'm really glad you say that, Elliot, because I think you've hit the nail on the head, and I think the point you're making is a broader movement here that I've never quite understood about our society, and it's the whole accepting and loving yourself self-esteem movement. Now, I'm not talking about loving yourself conceptually and saying, I like that I exist and I have a right to exist and I can be who I want to be, but it's sort of saying, I'm stuck here. I am this way and I have to love and accept that, not say this is who I am and this is who I would like to be. I'm going to work towards that. And the fat acceptance move is just an offshoot of that.
Yeah.
You know, I was a bigger guy myself in my 20s and I completely empathize with you, Elliot. And I don't understand folks who would drag someone down like that, or try to even drag someone down, would see someone else's achievement as a jealous sort of, it's so envious and so wicked. I can't understand that kind of psychology. It repulses me.
And I agree completely. And can I just say my experience as a skinny person for a second?
Go ahead.
That's oppressive and white.
It's definitely white. I don't know if it's oppressive. I don't know if I could oppress anyone with how small I am. But, you know, that's a comment I get a lot, where people are like, well, you just have a natural metabolism that makes you skinnier. Or, you know, that's just your genetics. But if you look at me and you look at me in comparison to my family, they're all overweight and they all have guts. And it's because of the lifestyle they live and the habits they have. Part of the reason I've never gained weight is I never drank. Cause I'm straight edge, and people don't understand that the drinking people do in college causes them to gain a lot of weight. And then what about all the work I've put in working out 5 days a week? Do you think that I just magically stayed this skinny and this fit by it just happened because of my genetics? Yeah, maybe I'm able to eat a little more McDonald's than somebody else, but I am as skinny as I am because of the work I put in, and it goes both ways. So William, you know, what you're talking about is they're pulling somebody down, but if you're accepting fat people because that's just the way they are, well, you're also saying skinny people didn't earn what they are. And that's offensive too.
Yeah. Yeah, people should respect folks' body image the way, you know, you make your body like you make your character, and there's an objective standard that we can judge, but there's also the context that is important to understand. And, you know, that's why you can't just look on the surface of someone's character and make judgments, just like you can't look on the surface of someone's body and make judgments. You don't know what the context is. Make judgments, just don't make hasty judgments.
Mm-hmm. Judge properly.
Final Reddit. And this is the cat one because of what William referenced in the last one. So if anyone wanted to hear us talk about video games, you can send hate tweets to William. William, you want to tell them your Twitter?
It's LaForge, LaForge underscore is my Twitter handle.
All right. So if you have any problems there, send it to Jordy LaForge.
Yep. That's who it's named after.
Last Reddit. My roommate kicked my cat so hard that we were having to put her down. Move or call the cops? So my question is, based upon the grammar here, is who are you putting down? The cats or the roommate?
Or the cops.
No, her implies that it's one person.
Oh my goodness. Isn't that one of the markers of pathological behavior? You're a psychopath when you do these kind of things to animals.
I don't know, but I've read the story, and apparently the drunken roommate kicked the cat and caused, like, severe damage. The cat had to be put down. Reddit, of course, came to the rescue, because this is exactly the kind of story that Reddit loves and people get all excited over. So, it was gross pictures and everything. I wouldn't click on the link if you're a pet lover. But yeah, it was, it's really disturbing that someone would hurt someone's pet like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what would possess someone to do it. Was there a story in here? I honestly didn't click through. I just thought it was a funny headline.
Yeah, I didn't see a story about, like, why the roommate kicked it, other than he said he was drunk when he did it. So, I guess that's an excuse for anything. I was drunk. I mean, can you use that as an excuse for, like, I voted for Obama, I was drunk? I mean, I don't know what the limit is of I was drunk excuse.
Yeah, I think the entire country was drunk at that point then.
Or most of them.
So yeah, don't kick your cat.
Really? You made me keep this story and that's your wisdom? Don't kick your cat?
I can't say anything more than that. I mean, it was so weird to see, like, someone, like, having to deliberate whether they should call the cops or move out. And it was, what ended up happening was Reddit convinced him to call the cops and have the landlord kick the roommate out. Mm-hmm. And that seemed like a reasonable response to me.
Or I'd probably add sue the roommate for damages for what you did to the cat. I mean, there are some medical treatments for when they put him down. I mean, that costs money. At the very least, the roommate ought to pay for that.
Yeah, and pay for a replacement. Not that you can replace a living thing, but there's certainly costs associated with replacing getting a new cat.
Oh. All right. Let's go on to the final segment. Find out who we name this weekend. Name a narcissist. I'd rather die than let you ever get away with this. You are the antithesis, narcissist. This kiss could be upon my own lips. I'd rather die. As I promised earlier in the episode, we're going to be bringing up football here. So if anyone...
Woohoo!
Yeah, woohoo indeed. I don't know how LA feels, but we got to straighten this podcast up a little bit.
Exactly. I'm ready.
So... if anyone saw the news last week, Daniel Tosh went on a supposedly comedic rant where he compared Tom Brady to Trent Dilfer, and he basically said that all the Patriots championships mean nothing. Were you guys able to watch this rant to see it?
I did. Noted sportscaster and sports commentator Tosh, Daniel Tosh. Yeah, I watched it. Sometimes I don't understand his humor either, so I guess I'm not the best judge of this sort of thing, but his whole point was that, Brady's just sort of sits back there and is just a play caller, you know? He doesn't really contribute anything. And, we know that's not true. I mean, it's just objectively not true. I don't even understand what the humor of the situation is.
Well, and that's what I'm asking. Knowing that Daniel Tosh is a Dolphins fan, is this just him being narcissistic and saying his bitterness on TV as if it means something because he has a platform? Or is there any validity to what he's saying? Because, you know, he's comparing Tom Brady to Trent Dilfer here, where Trent Dilfer won a title with the Ravens, because the Ravens had a really good defense back in, was the 2002 season, I believe, or maybe it was the, no, I think it was the 2000 season, the year before the Patriots won their first Super Bowl. So people say Trent Dilfer is not that good of a quarterback. But if you look at Trent Dilfer and you look at the commentary he gives, he routinely gives some of the smartest commentary out of any analyst that's out there. So I actually think Trent Dilfer gets a lot of disrespect for winning the Super Bowl, where they just say he's a quote-unquote game manager. Isn't it narcissistic in itself for these people who don't play football to comment on it as if they know what these quarterbacks do and they can rate them?
It's especially narcissistic because, you know, Tosh is not exactly someone who would be picked to play football. I mean, he's not exactly beefy, doesn't look very fast. I mean, he's not... If football is about your physical prowess, you know, Daniel Tosh is not someone who would be up on the top of my list of physical prowess, even among, you know, talking heads on TV. So, you know, to discount the whole intellectual side of football, which there is a tremendous intellectual side to football, I think it's just very narcissistic.
Right. I agree. Elliot?
Isn't this what we've been, in a way, it's kind of the theme that we've been talking about with football this whole, since the Super Bowl pretty much, and even a little bit before that. It's the idea that people, that winning a game just happens. You know, that people don't win games, games are won independently of people. That's kind of the way that that sports journalism and a lot of the people in the media and people like Daniel Tosh, when he makes these kind of comparisons, I think that's the root of all of this. You know, they've divorced the idea of winning from the actual actions that have taken place on the field. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's why there's so much disrespect for these two gentlemen, for Tom Brady and for, what's his name, Trent, what?
Trent Dilfer, for these two gentlemen, Trent Dilfer. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big, you know, the big thing, that, because we've talked about this before. People don't, they will do anything to convince themselves that a person hasn't actually won something.
Well, and this goes back to the Oscars wanting naturalism, and this even goes back to the fat acceptance we were talking about. This is why this episode is called the Everything Isn't Awesome edition. I mean, that's a glib joke, a tongue-in-cheek reference to the Lego movie not winning, but it's also to the fact that by having these certain movies win, by having fat acceptance, by, you know, accepting that Daniel Tosh has a right to say what he says, we make it so nothing can be awesome because everything is just how it's supposed to be and it's just all deterministic. And then we see how that swings around to narcissism, because the only thing that matters if everything's deterministic is just how I feel about it, how it makes me react to things. And then we get these bitter rants.
Bitter rants. This week's episode of The Midside.
No. It's the Everything Isn't Awesome edition. And we're actually going to address this in coming weeks. Daniel said he wants to add a segment where we're going to be positive in the future. So look out for that segment. Hopefully we'll introduce that next week. But for now,
oh, that'll be great.
Let's put a cap on this episode. What did we learn this week, Elliot?
I learned that we can do a whole Reddit story about cats and not do one pussy joke. Go us.
William?
I learned that I should use a needs-based test to build my fantasy football team for next year, so I'll only be drafting Lions and Dolphins players.
Oh, wow, that was a good joke. I like that one. And I learned never to walk in a situation where there's three guys and two of them are gay, because you're going to be outgayed pretty badly, and it's not going to be a straight podcast anymore.
Double-teamed.
Yeah, that would have been a funnier way to say it. Good point. I've also learned that Daniel is important for many things, including shilling for the podcast. So what I'm going to say is you guys should head to Facebook and like our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/themidside. This is our podcast webpage where you keep up with all the latest news on the podcast. But also, each of us tends to post articles there as a way of letting you guys know what we're coming across and thinking is absurd or awesome over the past week. And it's also where we call our content from for the next episode. So you can engage with our minds on a daily basis and also get a preview for what's coming up on the episode. So like that page on Facebook and share it with your friends. Mm-hmm. I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into The Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day! I can't believe we did all that segment about cats and we never brought up a pussy joke. The go us.
Go I us. Know.
Gay podcast.
No pussy reference.
Hey, it's only a gay podcast because you're not being straight.
I'm not.
I don't know. You had an ample opportunity to bring up pussy.
I just, whatever.
Straight edge.